This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are talking with Richard Slotkin. We're talking about Abraham Lincoln in the local, and we're talking about lots of universals. Back to fathers and sons.
Yes. Abe's insight into slavery has to come from something in his childhood. And one of there's a whole set of stories told about him by people for whom he worked. For wages in the small Indiana settlement that he spent most of his young years in.
Now, these are real stories?
These are real stories, or real as, you know...
you didn't
human
make
beings.
Them up. Somebody
no,
might have,
that's
but it
right,
wasn't
you. That's right. These are there are wonderful collections of lore, which is really collections of rumor gathered over the years about Lincoln. To a novelist, to a historian, they're useless because you can't really adjudicate true and false. To a novelist, they're revealing when they fall into some kind of consistent pattern because they at least show what kind of impression people had of him. It's a whole group of things which indicate, far from Lincoln being the dutiful, laborious clerk in the grocery store, that he hated manual labor and that he'd rather have been reading. That when his father would hire him out, he would take a book with him and sneak off and read. And then the people he worked for had all kinds of stories about how they had to constantly stir him up and get him back on the job. And one irate farmer said to him, didn't your pappy teach you how to work? And Abe answered, he taught me how to work, but not how to love it.
Well, it's also important to remember that in the time of which you speak, that there was quite a different relationship between fathers and sons and work, and that it really was a matter of almost servitude.
Well, yes. The father had the right to all of the son's wages until the son was 21 years old.
And he could put him to whatever task he chose,
right.
He the father.
That's right.
And then he got to take all the money.
Yeah, the whole product. Now, a generous father wouldn't take the whole wage, but Tom Lincoln was not a generous man in that way. And that, it seems to me, is a way in which a poor white boy growing up in that time and place could see an analogy between himself and the slave, particularly since the slaves that Abe would have met in his earliest youth were slaves from Kentucky coming across to trade with their masters and even to work in local salt mines and so on, who were hired out for wages to their master. The difference he would have perceived is that he was going to escape when he turned 21. All he had to do is, as I say, grow out the hair on his chest, and he'd be free, whereas the blacks would be kept in this humiliating condition for the rest of their life.
So he had experienced the humiliation,
yes.
In your words.
Yes, as I imagine him, yes, he would have had to experience that humiliation. I have to say that as a novelist, you're using not only the documented record of Lincoln specific or local information, but also general things that you know, how kids grow up, the dynamic between fathers and sons, what humiliation is about, what shame, what kinds of things people feel shamed about.
When a historian writes a novel, it's always interesting to me because frequently it appears that the novel represents a truer representation mm-hmm. of history,
yes.
than most histories do, because you do have the latitude to go to work with the data that's there and to try to make sense of it in mm-hmm. a way that when you work solely from facts and that are always limited and always selected,
yes.
That you don't have that limit. Is that a fair representation?
I think it is a fair representation. I think there is a kind of truth in historical fiction. The way that I formulated for myself is that in a novel, I tell you what I know. In a work of nonfiction, I tell you what I can prove. And there's a difference there. I think that when I publish these things, I always try to play fair with the reader. I label my novel a novel. It is not a docudrama. It is not a nonfiction novel. The truth there is...
It's a novel.
It's a novel. It is a work of fiction. I have imagined many, many details. In fact, I feel that if put to it, I could argue my interpretation, use citing fact. But there is no citation of fact. And I mess a little bit with chronology. I invent dialogue. I invent relationships.
But it is also worth asking, are some of the fundamental touchstones along the way, did Lincoln really go down the Mississippi?
Yes, he did.
That kind of stuff.
Yes. The main turns in his life have to be real.
So you didn't just think, oh, well, it worked for Huck Finn. It ought to work for...
No. In fact, just the opposite. I didn't really think of Lincoln as a subject for fiction until when I was teaching a course in Mark Twain. It struck me that young Huck Finn was a kind of stand-in for Lincoln. Poor boys, really smart, no schooling, bad father, dead mother, goes down the Mississippi on a raft or a flatboat, and learns what slavery and race are really all about when he does it. And that resemblance was enough to... that was the hook
was
that drew
that
me into the story.
Was that a great big light bulb over your head when that
yep,
connection
yep,
happened?
Yep, it was Eureka, you know, the
Holy
light goes on.
Cow.
Yeah.
Well, there are those who would argue that Huck Finn is the great American novel.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the candidates for that. And it's it again, to go back to myth again for a second, even though it's not a work of history or from history directly, the Huck Finn story has certainly become an American myth. So again, I wanted to remind the reader of what the reader already knows and to do different things from Twain so that the reader could see the limitation of that old story. Twain, writing in the 1880s, has a black character, Jim, who is he's just good, he's just sweet, he's gentle, and he's ultimately subservient to Huck. To us now, this is a painful, in some ways, a painful racial stereotype. At the time, it is an illumination of the humanity on the other side of the color line. Moreover, at a time when the stereotype of the black male is of a violent predator, if Twain had given Jim any capacity for violence, he would have been pandering to the worst capacities of American society. But this is the year 2000. And what I need to represent for the reader is a fuller humanity on the other side, which includes the American capacity for violence.
And a fuller capacity to understand Abraham Lincoln
as
not being one-dimensional.
That's right. That's right. That the black man Lincoln sees can't be an easy black man. He has to be a tough black man.
And Lincoln is not an easy white man.
And Lincoln is not an easy white man. No, he's a hard... He's potentially a hard case. The thing about Lincoln, he's got this compassion for which he's famous, and which is a genuine compassion, because you can't see the humanity across the color line unless you're capable of that kind of compassion. On the other hand, the iron fist, the ability to take your moral ground and stick to it through the worst bloodshed in American history, and make no compromises, cut any deals to get out of it, but fight it right through to the end.
And reviled by your friends and supporters.
That's right. Through the most hateful
kinds
of campaign.
It's one thing to have your enemies detest you. It's something else to have your friends share that view.
Yeah. And he never deviates. He will obfuscate. He will be dodgy. He will be tricky. He will seem to backpedal. But as Frederick Douglass said, when you look at the record, he stepped more slowly than some of us would have wished. But once he stepped forward, he never took a step back. Now, that's iron. And the willingness to go through violence and bloodshed to achieve that aim takes a lot of iron. So he's got to have, as a child, he's got to show a capacity to do harm.
We today seem to live in a mythic muddle.
That's a technical term.
It's a technical term. I didn't learn it from your book. Part of what you've done, myths after a while tend to get thin if they're not revitalized.
Yes. Yeah,
they just get thinner and thinner and thinner, and after a while, you just have this icon that is Lincoln or Washington or whatever, and it looks like they are separated from humanity.
Well, they're cartoon figures.
They cease to become reasonable examples of what we can become, which is part of, I think, what your book does. It makes it human. It makes it possible for people to rise above themselves to understand the complexity and richness and the challenges that people like that are faced with. But I say that about the mythic muddle because I want to bring Lincoln to the year 2000 and beyond, or what you've started to do, the notion of myth. What you represent is a mythology that sustained us maybe to Vietnam.
Yeah, I would say so.
And then it went away. sort of.
It didn't go away, but it got it took heavy damage and started coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Is this still the myth of violence regenerating the?
Yes,
ethos?
We still have it. We still have it. But I think that the idea of the mythic muddle, I would be sharper than that. I would say it's a crisis that we have, that the old myths failed in Vietnam, and that there is no coherent fable of American history that organizes the concept for us the way the old heroic patriotic mythologies did. When that happens to a culture, when that happens to a people, what they do is they reassess them, they pull out the memory banks, they riffle through them and rework the past. Is there anything useful for us anymore in Lincoln? The death of Washington as a possible hero for American boys, it came because there's nothing in it. We can't start the Republic again.
This is Richard Slotkin, and we're going to let him finish this thought when we come back in just a moment. Hold that thought, please. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Please be with us when we return.